weapons and skills that will be useful. I am commandeering that access. What do we get out of it? A short, scarred man growled. Garln Veal. Racketeering. Tithe evasion. Kidnapping and drug trafficking. That left the other two. Paul Deeks and Canna Jurst. Both were narcotics dealers and murderers for hire. Deeks was a slim man, void-born. Jurst was a muscular woman with a shaved head and steel teeth. Neither met his gaze.
You get to survive, Cowder said.
You'll kill us if we refuse? Drum asked.
Yes, here and now. Those who agree will be allowed to divide up the operations of those who refuse.
Doesn't do us much good if we die in battle, Veal said.
Like you're planning to be on the front line, Belloc said.
Veal lunged for him and got an enforcer's baton across his ribs for his efforts. Belloc laughed and looked at Calder.
What about after, if we survive? What then? You are no longer my concern at that point. What you do is up to you.
The criminals looked at one another. Calder saw Drum nod slightly, and Belloc grunted.
Fine, we'll do it.
Calder nodded.
You will liaise with Swordmaster Tyre. I will require accurate data as to the resources available to you. If you shirk your new responsibilities, I will personally hunt you down and kill you, as well as every member of your organization. Is this understood?
He didn't raise his voice. He didn't need to. Even Belloc blanched, but Calder noticed that he was looking at Karos. He turned away.
Dismissed!
As the enforcers escorted Belloc and the others out, Calder joined Karos at the top of the dais.
Expertly done, brother.
The Raven Guard sounded amused.
I work with the tools I'm given. Is that what they are, then?
Calder nodded, studying the projections above.
Every soul on this planet is a tool. They must be, if we are to defend this world. Every warm body is another brick in the wall. I know that saying. Dawn, wasn't it? Yes.
Karos was silent for a time. Then...
They say that you met Dawn.
Calder glanced at him.
Yes. You spoke with him? Once?
Karos's expression was hard to read.
What was it like?
He asked softly, almost hesitantly.
What was it like to speak to your primogenitor?
Calder paused, wondering how best to answer. How to explain that a demigod had seemed tired, almost worn down to mere mortality. How to explain how Dawn's walls had crumbled in those last fraught months. He possessed no words that could do justice to such sadness. Finally, he said,
I shall remember it always. He was our father and our teacher, the soul of us and the foundation upon which we are built.
Karos sighed and nodded.
What would they think of us now, I wonder?
He looked around the chamber, at the faded murals and signs of age and wear on the walls. Calder followed his gaze, taking in the cracks in the stones, the tarnished metal of the braziers, the faded draperies. There were echoes of glory here, but the best days of this palace, of this world, were long past.
He would be proud, I think. They would be proud. The galaxy is a pyre, but we endure the flames and press on. We are wounded, but not defeated. They would be proud of us, brother, as Gilliman is proud, though we are not his sons.
Calder looked down at the Raven Guard.
As I am proud to fight alongside you and Sabodan, whether this ends in victory or death, I am glad to have this moment, and to serve beside such warriors as you both, wherever they are, whatever their fate. Our gene fathers see us, and they are proud. I want to believe you are right, brother. With all my heart, I want to believe.
Karos smiled sadly.
But I cannot help but feel you are wrong, that they would see us, see this,
and know only disappointment. To know that all they bled for has come to this.
He grunted and shook his head.
Such thoughts are wasteful, though. They serve no purpose, save morose rumination. And we have more important matters to discuss. You wish to go to the asteroid mines?
Karras blinked.
Yes.
Cowder allowed himself a brief smile.
I know how your chapter thinks, brother. You seek the oblique approach in every strategy. You think that they will attempt to take the mines. I think that they must. The asteroid belt is a ready-made fortress, from a certain perspective. The equipment there could easily be repurposed into de facto orbital defences, and the void trawlers turned into everything from troop transports to fireships to limited engagement fighters. Their hulls are designed to withstand debris that would cripple a frigate. Slow as blazes, but with a debris lance or a plasma cutter mounted on them, they'd make a deadly opponent for enemy vessels moving through the asteroid field. If the enemy are smart, and we have seen little to suggest otherwise, they'll move to claim control of the asteroid field, as well as the facilities there. And the revolutionaries that Tyre mentioned, we will deal with them,
Karras said firmly.
One way or another, they will not be allowed to use this situation to their advantage.
Calder nodded.
You know your business, brother, as well as the Bowden knows his. If you believe that this is where you are most useful, I will not argue. And that, brother, is why Gilliban put you in charge.
Karras' smile was sharp.
Build your walls, and I will see that the enemy cannot dig them out from under you.
He paused.
But before I go...
He tilted his head up and gave a bird-like trill. A slim shape appeared as if from nowhere. Karras gestured, and the Reaver stepped forward. A Primaris, like Calder, the Reaver wore lighter-weight ceramite armor, streamlined for greater mobility and silence. Calder wondered where he'd been hiding.
This is Solaro, one of my best.
Calder nodded, somewhat taken aback by the other Primaris's stealthy approach, and Solaro bowed. Calder looked at Karras.
And why is he here? I thought you might find him useful, regarding the matter we discussed earlier. Solaro is adept at being in the right place at the right time. He knows how not to be noticed, a skill I have always found to be helpful.
Karras pointed at the Reaver, whose stoic expression betrayed nothing of what he might think about the discussion.
I make you a gift of this blade, brother. Use it as you see fit.
Calder bowed his head.
I thank you for the gift, brother. I'll put him to good use.
Karras thumped his chest in salute.
I am glad to hear it. Build strong walls, Calder. I will see that the enemy are bloody before they reach them.
Chapter 13 720932 Odoasis System Corward Edge. The mutant whimpered as a Matnim plucked a goblet from the tray it held. More mutants, decrepit, worm-pale things born in the lowest decks of the Glory Eternal, circulated through the ship's strategium, offering drinks and sweetmeats to the gathered word-bearers. Imatnam watched them. They made him curious, these creatures. They always had. Was this, then, what the gods wanted? Was this the end result awaiting humanity? Should the gods triumph over their great foe? Enforce servitude, strangers in their own flesh, cowed and barely human at all? He remembered similar drudges aboard similar vessels in the days before the Great Liberation. Perhaps there was no difference. Humanity would serve one god or another, would be ruled by one brotherhood of demigods or the other. Perhaps that was simply the way of it. He banished the thought with a swallow of wine. It was an excellent vintage. Plundered from some Aldari trading enclave. Light. Crisp. With a hint of strange spice. He had come to prefer their wine to that made by humans. The bitterness of a failed race added something to the taste. He looked around the chamber. Lacamhew wasn't drinking, of course. Dark apostles were abstemious sorts, even those that devoted their prayers to the Dark Prince. But the others seemed to be enjoying themselves. That was good. A bit of cheer before the bad news. He took another sip and cleared his throat. The gathered word-bearers fell silent.
"I am certain that you have all noticed that we are under attack," he said.
He activated the Strategium star map, an immense hololithic projection that filled the chamber. Motes of light, representing star clusters and celestial phenomena, surrounded the word-bearers. Half-visible shapes squirmed just beneath the glare, like eels in murky water. At Amatnin's gesture, a series of runes representing the fleet flashed to life. Other runes representing the elements of the fleet he'd sent out as predation forces flickered as well. There were fewer of these now than there ought to have been. Worse, they were retreating, as per the latest reports.
"We've lost four vessels since Pergamon, four battle-tested ships, as well as escorts and assault craft. The White Scars," Apis said.
Murmurs accompanied this statement. A Magnum called up a pick capture. It bloomed to his right, spreading like paint across a canvas. It showed a distorted image of an asteroid field, and bursts of light that all of them could identify as macro-cannon fire.
"Yes and no. This is a frame from the sensor feed of Kallion's yearning. Even in his final moments, our departed brother, Ashu, served the Legion. This is the vessel that killed him."
The pick capture was rotated and magnified so that the ship hidden amongst the asteroids was revealed. Black. Sleek. At once stripped down and lethal. The hull was sloped strangely, perhaps to better baffle sensor sweeps.
"That, my brothers, is no White Scars vessel."
"Korax's whelps," Lacomhugh ground. "They often flock with the Khan's jackals."
Amatnim smiled. "And what about this one?" The pick capture wavered, changed. A new image. Another field of asteroids, and beyond them, a world of blues and browns.
"This is Almais. The image you're seeing was provided courtesy of our new allies."
More murmurs at this. Apis and the others had little patience for mortals. Amatnim pressed on. He magnified the image. A speck of yellow beyond the asteroids grew into a wedge-shaped cruiser, marked with a sigil shaped like a clenched gauntlet. Impossible to misidentify that livery. Like those who bore it, it had not changed in millennia.
"The Sons of Dawn," Apis said.
A sigh ran through the chamber.
"What does this mean?"
Kellum asked. He'd proven himself in the attack on Pergamon, and Amatnim had raised him up to replace Ashu in his council of war.
"It means we are in for a fight," Apis said.
Several of the others laughed.
"We're already in a fight," Amatnim corrected. "We just didn't realize it."
He dismissed the pick captures.
"Their strategy is simple but effective. They are forcing us to contract our forces as our captains try to avoid being picked off piecemeal. Their numbers are small, but they're putting them to good use. I underestimated their pragmatism."
Kellum studied the placement of the fleet's ident runes.
"They're ignoring our attacks on the outer worlds and focusing on the isolated wings of our fleet."
"I would do the same," Apis said. "Worlds can be rebuilt after victory is won."
"Perhaps we should simply do as they wish,"
Kellum said. He looked at Apis.
"Come together and then smash them in open battle."
Apis shook his head.
They won't play that game. They'll isolate stragglers and bleed us until we give chase, and then they'll vanish until the whole process starts again. Smart.
If they will not come to us, we must go to them,
Lacomhugh growled.
We must cut off their avenues of retreat, encircle them in a ring of iron, and crush them.
That will take time, Amatnim said. And all the while, Almais fortifies itself.
Lacomhugh looked at him.
You weren't worried about that earlier.
That was before I realized why they were employing this particular strategy. If the Imperial Fists garrison that world, every moment we waste gives them time to dig in just a little deeper.
He turned to the Dark Apostle.
"We are not iron warriors, brother. I don't know about you, but I have never enjoyed sieges. Two, there are elements of at least three chapters of our milk-blood cousins involved in this defence. That implies that our presence here has been noted by elements outside the system. There is no guarantee that reinforcements aren't en route even now." Kellum grunted.
"Even so, we need to bring them to battle. All the data indicates that we outnumber them significantly. Even half our fleet should be enough."
Amatnim nodded. "I would prefer they not dog our heels the entire way, even if that means splitting the fleet to deal with them. The problem is, we don't know where they're going to strike."
"But what if we did?"
Kellum asked. Amatnim looked at him.
"What do you propose, brother?"
"We know the rules now. I say we beat them at their own game. We draw them into ground of our choosing and strike. If the gods are with us, one strike is all we will need."
Amatnim smiled. "An excellent plan. Are you volunteering to play the huntsman?" Kellum paused, considering. Amatnim was pleased by his hesitation. Kellum was smart. He saw the request was at once an honour and a challenge. If he succeeded, he might win high acclaim. If he failed, likely he would be punished, if he survived. But even presented as a request, it was a command, and he was wise enough to realize it. He nodded.
"I will run them down, my lord, and offer them up to the Lord of Skulls."
"Excellent. Lorgar's word will make a fine flagship. It's fast and durable. Take the Yocephalot, the Skullhound, and Dagmar's Penitence, as well as any of our new auxiliaries who wish to go. I suggest paying attention to the refugee convoys. They'll be looking to protect them, or perhaps use them as bait. It's what I would do in their place."
Amatnim turned.
"The rest of the fleet will continue to Almes."
"What of the ships still in dry dock?"
Apis asked.
"Leave them. Skeleton crews only.
The carrion birds will be picking over Pergo for months yet, and there'll be slaves and salvage aplenty to aid in the repairs. Two, we may need to regroup, and Pergo will be the perfect fallback position."
"You fear defeat?"
Lackamhew said. The others fell silent. Apis's hand fell to the pistol at his hip. Amatnim glanced at him, and Apis relaxed.
"I do not fear, brother. I am prepared. Contrary to popular opinion, one must consider the possibility of setbacks when one plans a military campaign. If the gods turn their eyes from us, and you're a liar if you think they are not fickle, then it is best that we are ready with a contingency. Pergo will make an ideal staging area. It can be made defensible readily. The population, what's left of it, is adequate for labor purposes. And more importantly, we already control it."
Lackamhew made as if to argue further, but instead settled back, frowning. He had been unusually quiet since the revelations in the library. That was good. It meant he was thinking. Amatnim waited a moment, and then continued with the briefing. But all the while, he watched Lackamhew. He watched too as Yattle murmured in the Dark Apostle's ear. He did not have to guess as to what they were saying. Yattle was his now as much as Lackamhew's, and it was Amatnim's words that the warrior whispered to his former master. Lackamhew would make a strong ally if he could be turned from his chosen path, but if fate decreed otherwise, Yattle would be there to put a knife in. He felt no satisfaction at the thought. It was also unbearably tedious. Once, the Legion's factionalism had been nothing more than competition. Now, it was a war, fought not with gun and blade, but with words and deeds. Every host was a campaign in and of itself, often splintering in victory as easily as in defeat. Sometimes he thought the gods demanded more than a man could give. More blood, more pleasure, more hope, more despair. It was all too much. It turned warriors into slaves. The gods could not help that it was their nature to demand worship, to take all that was given, Like a roaring fire, they fed on whatever they were given, spreading and rising unchecked. Most men were wise enough to feed them only a little. There were always some fools who just wanted to watch everything burn. But from the ashes, new growth would rise. From the fires of this victory, the word-bearers would be reborn, and the Urizen would have no choice but to return to them. Or so the gods had promised. Prince Ganor Kabalevsky stood at the center of the strategium chamber, one hand on his shuriken pistol.
"Quiet," he said.
Then more loudly,
"Quiet! I invited you here to talk, not scream at each other like frightened pilgrims."
The other pirates kept shouting. A dozen of his fellow captains crowded his vessel's strategium. Some, like Amina Deal and Fisher Hoon, he knew well. Others, like Skinner Jade, he knew only by reputation. All of them had clawed out an existence on the fringes of the Odoacer system, preying on merchant ships and pilgrim convoys. But, like him, they wanted something more out of life. The problem was, none of them could quite agree as to just what more might be. Hence his invitation to them to come aboard his ship and talk. His vessel, like the rest, drifted near the word-bearer's fleet. Close, but not a part of it. Far enough away to run, if negotiations took a wrong turn. It was also one of the largest vessels in the impromptu pirate flotilla that now trailed in the word-bearer's wake. That gave him a certain seniority, not that the others would admit it. The strategium chamber was old and hadn't seen the attentions of an engine seer in decades. Bundles of loose cabling spilled from the ceiling, and the ancient stonework was chipped and grimy. The flagstones of the floor were covered in the detritus of a thousand similar war councils. The hololithic projectors had stopped working years ago, and he'd been forced to invest in old-fashioned star maps, bought at exorbitant prices from rogue traders and black market merchants. It was also too small for this sort of meeting. But there was no way he was letting any of his peers near the bridge of his ship. Trust was a precious commodity among pirates, but there was no reason to test it unduly. At last, annoyed by their shouting, he drew his shuriken pistol and fired, shattering a lumen and raining glass down on the chamber. They fell silent at once and turned towards him as a group. He studied them, frowning. Ganor knew two things about pirates. One, they were, by nature, eminently pragmatic. Two, they had little respect for authority, especially of the assumed sort. To the eyes of his fellows, he had committed the cardinal sin of seemingly disregarding pragmatism and taking up the mantle of leader. He'd known this going in, but someone had to do it, and he thought it might as well be him. After all, he was royalty. Had been royalty. Before the Adeptus Ministerum had stolen his family's holdings and stripped them of their titles and tithe privileges. He remembered his mother weeping as ecclesiarchal thugs had stripped their home down to the bare walls. He brushed the memory aside, even as he spoke to his guests.
"My apologies, but we won't get anywhere shouting at one another like this."
"Who are you to give us orders, Ganor?"
Amina Deal stepped forward, shoving several others aside. She was a big woman, with the muscles of a labourer, and a face that might have been pretty once, in a certain light. A variety of tattoos, cruder than his own, covered her bare arms, neck and face. Golden rings perforated her earlobes, nostrils and lips, and her hair had been pulled back into a fraying braid.
"For that matter, who are you to speak for us?"
There were mutters at this. Deal seemed to be the spokeswoman. Ganor made a placatory gesture.
"I understand your anger, brothers and sisters. But someone had to stand up."
"Why you?" Deal pressed.
"A better question is,
why not any of you?"
Ganor swept the group with a challenging gaze.
"Why didn't any of you seize the opportunity fate has handed us?"
"Throwing in our lot with monsters requires consideration," Deal said.
Ganor laughed.
"Ha! We're all monsters, woman.
every one of us. Not these kind of monsters,
someone snarled. Fisher Hoon. He was a pale man, covered in keloid scars and wearing a battered set of carapace armour.
I'm all for plunder, but...
He trailed off, shaking his head.
But what? Ganor said. Don't tell me you're afraid.
You're not, Deal said.
No, because I see the opportunities before us for what they are.
Almaes is ripe for the plucking, and you heard them. They don't want it. They'll go back to whatever hell spawned them when they're finished.
Hoon laughed.
Ha! Yes, because you can always trust men covered in dried blood and skulls.
He spat and shook his head.
You're an idiot, Ganor. You hear only what you want to hear. They can't be trusted.
Then why haven't you left yet?
Ganor looked at him.
Huh? Why haven't any of you left? If you're so scared, so fearful of seizing this opportunity, why are you still here? Because they'll fire on us if we do.
That was Skinner Jade, old as pirates judge things, with a prosthetic arm and a metal plate where part of his skull had once been. He had scars where old tattoos had been scraped from his flesh and wore filthy fatigues. He ran his mechanical claw through his wispy hair and continued.
Can't have us talking to the enemy, can they? It's already too late. We got too close, too greedy. Now they have us.
He coughed and looked around, rheumy eyes skittering over the others.
Ganor is right. Our only chance is to throw in with them and hope they're telling the truth.
It wasn't quite the sterling endorsement Ganor had been hoping for, but beggars couldn't be choosers. Jade had influence among the younger captains. He held to his word, which was rare, and was always willing to join forces if the price was right. The same couldn't be said for Hoon or some of the others.
Jade is right. The time is now. Almaes, the system, is ours, if we but reach out and take it. The Imperium has forgotten us. Travel outside the system is all but impossible. We could divide the Odoesa system up between us, brothers and sisters.
Between those of us who survive, you mean?
Hoon said.
To the winners, the spoils.
You don't know what they'll win.
Ganor shrugged.
My contacts on Almaes have told me everything I need to know, he said. As have yours, I'm sure. There's barely a company's worth of space marines on that planet. You saw what our new benefactors did to Purgo. You think they won't do the same to Almaes?
He looked around.
Face facts, brothers and sisters. The Cardinal Governor's time is coming to an end. The people will see and rise up. Hell, they're already rising up on the outer worlds, even in the asteroid facilities near Almaes itself.
Deal snorted.
Optimistic of you, Ganor. More like riots than uprisings. And let's not even get started on the asteroid miners. Those rock hounds don't care about anyone who isn't Voidborn. Not exactly an army.
Doesn't have to be, sister.
And don't call me sister, you jumped-up wannabe Aristo pants. You think you're the only one whose family got driven to the fringes because they crossed the Ecclesiarchy?
She looked around.
Jade's right. This is a mistake. Picking sides in a war is never smart. We should have just stuck to picking the bones, like we always do.
Hoon nodded.
We're far enough away. We can go. They won't chase us. Why bother?
There were murmurs of agreement. Running sounded better than fighting any day.
And then what?
Ganor snarled.
Hey! And then what? How long before the Ecclesiarchy sends their new space marine attack dogs to purge our enclaves? And what if a Matnim wins? Would he spare us, do you think?
He would not.
The voice, deeper than a man's and hideously resonant, caused them all to turn. Deal and some others went for their weapons, but paused as they saw the Dark Apostle stepping into the chamber, his monstrous blade slaves trudging in his wake. Lacamieux had his helm clamped to his thigh, and his scarred features twisted into an unsettling smile.
"Even if you do join us, there is every likelihood that we will butcher you, one and all. That is because you are meat, and destined for the fate of all meat."
"Then why should we help you?"
Deal hissed. Her hand was on her plasma pistol. Ganor surreptitiously reached for his own weapon. If Deal made a move, he would need to respond, though he wasn't sure whose side he would take.
"More importantly, how did you get aboard my ship?" he said.
Lacamieux laughed. It was an ugly sound, like meat hitting a butcher's block.
"I go where I wish. I kill who I like. The gods stand at my shoulder, and their blessings are upon me."
His eyes blazed with an unsettling light.
"That wasn't an answer," Ganor said.
He drew his pistol. The blade slaves tensed, growling softly. They were hideous things, not space marines anymore, but something else, like walking tumors. The swords they held hurt the eyes if you looked at them too long.
"Ta! You do not deserve an answer. Sheep do not question the shepherd. If you try to depart, we will kill you. We will board your ships and take your crews, and use their blood and yours to paint your hulls a pleasing crimson. And then your ships will serve us regardless."
He spread his arms.
"Rejoice, for your choices have narrowed to one. There is freedom in servitude, if you choose the right masters."
"The hell I will,"
Hoon snarled. Before any of them could react, Hoon had his weapon out, a bolt pistol. It boomed. One of the blade slaves slid swiftly in front of its master and intercepted the shot. Black ichor pulsed from the wound, and the creature grunted, but seemed otherwise unharmed. Hoon stared, as if in shock at his own actions. Lacamieux gestured, and his creatures lunged. They were faster than Ganor had thought possible, faster even than space marines. Despite their bulk, they were crimson blurs. He heard the shrill scrape of their blades, and Hoon screamed once. Just once. The other pirates scattered, as the hulking creatures slid through them, blades extended behind them. Hoon stayed where he was, silent, staring. Then he unraveled in a torrent of red. Meat and viscera flopped wetly to the floor as his bisected frame unfolded and slid down the shaft of his splintered spine. Lacamieux used his croziers to scoop up a length of intestine. He whistled, and the blade slaves returned to his side. He offered them the intestine, and they fell upon it greedily, fighting like hungry dogs for a taste, jaws snapping in the ruins of their helms. As they squabbled, he looked at Ganor.
"Come, he wishes to speak to you."
"A council of war,"
Ganor said, glancing at Deal and the others. Lacamieux grunted dismissively.
"Something like that."
Amatnim smiled as Lacamieux showed Ganor in. The pirate looked almost comical amid the dour crimson shapes of the word-bearers. A clown, a jester. But there was something in him, a seed that might yet blossom into greatness, if it were properly nurtured. And that, too, was the duty of his legion. Lorgar had bequeathed unto them responsibility for the souls of mankind, from the greatest lord to the meanest drudge. Amatnim intended to fulfill that responsibility.
"Ah! Welcome, Prince Ganor, welcome."
Ganor bobbed his head and took a wary glance around. His ambition burned in him like a flame, but it was tinged with fear. Amatnim set a comradely arm about his shoulders. I am told that you have some knowledge of Almes and the void around it. Is this true? Ganor flinched slightly at the weight of Amatnim's arm, but nodded.
I do. I was born there.
He frowned.
My family...
He trailed off. Amatnim nodded sympathetically.
I understand.
It is ever the way of the followers of the corpse god. The same story stretched across centuries. They take what rightfully belongs to others and claim it as their own. Amatnim brought up the system map. What can you tell me about these mining facilities here, dotting the asteroid fields around the planet? We've seen them here and there, but most of them are isolated, which is why we've ignored them. But the asteroid field between us and Almes is thicker than I anticipated, and riddled with them. Hundreds, even.
That's a good estimate, my lord,
Ganor said, peering at the display.
They grow by the decade. Used to only be a few. But now the asteroid field might as well be a city.
He scratched his chin.
When I was a boy, pirates used to raid them regularly.
But not now. Ganor cleared his throat.
No. The facilities here now have defensive capabilities. The others mostly lacked. It's basically a chain of interlinked forts. Not good ones, but more than any ship could handle on its own.
He leaned close, frowning.
They've got hop ships, weapons. That makes them too dangerous to be profitable.
Lacomhue laughed.
You do not know what that word means, mortal.
Ganor bristled.
I know enough,
he said hotly. At his tone, one of Lacomhue's slaves gave a grunt of warning, but the mortal paid little heed.
Just like I know that they aren't happy with the way things are.
Amatnim nodded. They slave for unfriendly masters.
That they do, your lordship. Not a pleasant life, being a roughneck. I should know. I have plenty among my crew.
Ganor scratched his cheek.
They might be amenable to a change of employment, you might say.
Lacomhue snorted.
Sis, we have plenty of slaves.
Ganor's hand dropped to his pistol. One of Lacomhue's blade slaves raised his weapon, the edge resting perilously close to Ganor's throat. The pirate froze. Amatnim sighed and pushed the weapon aside.
Control your hounds, brother.
You control yours,
Lacomhue said, glaring at the pirate. Ganor stepped back, stinking of fear. Amatnim shook his head.
Regardless, he is correct. Those facilities are too dangerous to be left sitting. We must take them before they become an impediment.
He turned. That will be your task, brother.
Mine?
Lacomhue said.
Send Apis. I would be in at the kill.
And I would that you were there. It is a vital task, brother, and one I entrust to you.
Lacomhue grimaced. Amatnim could feel the Dark Apostle's frustration. The bloody helms of his beasts twitched, as if they caught a scent. Amatnim gestured for Ganor to step back, and then, more discreetly, for Apis to put away his sidearm. One of the blade slaves lunged, unable to control itself, or perhaps at Lacomhue's instigation. The creature roared and swept its blade back for an overhead blow as it moved towards him. Amatnim twitched aside, and the blade narrowly missed him, before slamming into the floor. He could feel the heat of the runes etched into its length, even as he drove his fist into the side of the creature's head, momentarily stunning it. Demonically empowered though they were, the blade slaves were still limited, to some degree, by the physiology of their husks. They were faster than any legionary, but they still had bones and hearts and nerves. It was just a question of reaching them swiftly enough. Before it could rip its blade free, he had an arm about its neck, and a hand clamped to the top of its skull. He drove a knee into its spine and wrestled it to the floor, pinning it beneath his weight. It was undignified but effective. He heard Lacomhue shout, and the creature ceased its struggles.
Release him,
the Dark Apostle said. There was a hint of a plea there, but no apology. Amatnim sighed and looked at Lacomhue.
No.
Then, with a jerk and a twist, he tore the creature's head from its shoulders. The body thrashed like a dying serpent, and the survivor gave a keening, inhuman wail. He rose and tossed the head at Lacamhew's feet.
I told you to keep them under control. If you do not obey, there is no place for you here.
Lacamhew snarled and raised his croziers, but stopped as he heard the telltale click of weapons being readied. Apis and the others in the chamber had their bolt pistols aimed at the Dark Apostle. He bared his teeth and glared at them.
"Treachery," he said.
"Pragmatism," the Matnam said. "There is glory enough for all of us, brother. Do not fear. I will not deprive you of your just due."
Slowly, Lacamhew lowered his weapon. Without a word, he turned on his heel and departed, followed by his remaining slave. The Matnam made no move to stop him. He turned back to the map.
"Now, where were we?"
Chapter 14, 760007. Odoacer System. Corward Edge. Raven's Valor shuddered as lance strikes burned its flanks. Commander Raquin pounded a fist against the side of his command throne in frustration. The bridge view screen was a flurry of static, and barely half the strike cruiser's hull-mounted sensors were responding. Luckily, the weapon's batteries were still operational.
"Fire!"
he snarled. The order was relayed to the gunnery decks in dull monotones by the bridge servitors. A moment later, the strike cruiser shuddered again, this time in satisfaction, as its guns roared. Disruption macro cannons spat streams of ionized detritum atoms across the black, as heavier Hecuta plasma batteries unleashed phototonic salvos.
"My lord! Incoming transmission from the Silent Horseman!" a bridge serf called out. "Put it through,"
Raquin said, as the bridge shook again. A hololithic projection flickered to life before him, revealing Sabodan Khan's hawk-like features.
"Status, brother!"
"They were waiting for us, in the debris field between us and the core. As soon as we hit our target, they hit us. It seems you are not the only hunter in these stars, Khan."
Raquin winced as a wail of feedback cut through the vox.
"You were right. It was too easy."
Below, he saw servitors twitching in their thrones as blood seeped from their data ports.
"They used their own slaves as bait to draw us in."
"We're making for your coordinates now. Can you hold out?"
"We don't seem to have much of a choice,"
Raquin growled.
"They've got us boxed in, 2-1. Both heavy cruisers. I haven't managed to identify them yet."
"We can name them after we reduce them to scrap.
Hold fast, brother!"
Raquin cut the transmission and sat back. Damage estimates scrolled upwards across his helmet display. His battle plate was connected to the command throne by a number of contact ports, allowing him to swiftly receive and synthesize the data. At the moment, all he was receiving were various flavors of bad news. They'd been caught in a pretty trap. Dawn's Hand, the frigate that had been accompanying Raven's Valor, was burning somewhere off starboard. Communications were a confused garble of static. Likely their vox array had been damaged, but from the few images he'd got from the hull sensors, they didn't look to be in good shape. The Drusus was gone as well. The cruiser had been torn nearly in two by a lucky salvo. If any of its crew were still alive, they soon wouldn't be, once its engines reached critical mass. Raquin felt a flicker of regret. He'd quite liked the cruiser's energetic young captain. He supposed the mortal was dead now. The ship's bridge had been struck full on. The bridge shook again, and he was nearly wrenched from his command throne.
"Report!"
he barked.
"They're circling!"
a bridge serf said, coughing slightly. Smoke hung thick over the bridge now, and the circulation systems were faltering.
"It's like they're waiting, my lord!"
"Maybe we damaged them more badly than we thought,"
Raquin's second, Garrus, said. The other space marine stood at a tacticum console, where he'd been analyzing the enemy's firing patterns. He turned.
"Or maybe they're waiting for reinforcements."
Raquin turned.
"Have we re-established contact with Dawn's Hand?"
"No, my lord,"
a serf said.
Bring up sensor feeds if we've got one. Patch it to my command throne.
A hololithic image, badly distorted, flickered into view. The frigate was turning slowly through the void. Raquen could tell that it had lost power. Its thrusters were burning, but it was going nowhere. Already, swarms of gunships and assault boats were streaking towards it. The few attack craft available to Raven's Valor were attempting to intercept, but they wouldn't be enough. And beyond the dying frigate, the enemy hung in the void and watched, waited. Guns primed and ready, but not moving in for the kill. Raquen saw it then. They were waiting, but not for reinforcements.
"Divert secondary power to the Augur Array," he said. "Do a sweep. Look for pingbacks, especially deeper in the debris field." "My lord," Garrus said. "Do it now."
Raquen watched Dawn's hand convulse. If its engines overloaded and went up, they would catch the edge of its death throes. But if they moved, they'd be exposing themselves to the enemy. He laughed softly. Damned if they did, damned if they didn't. Garrus cursed. Raquen didn't look at him.
"How many?" "Two definites. At least twice that in potentials. Battle cruisers by the look of them. They're masking their signatures with the debris field. What are they waiting on?"
"The Silent Horsemen," Raquen said.
"This is a kill box. They draw us in, and now they're using us to draw in the rest of the fleet. Check our communications."
A squeal of feedback filled the bridge. Raquen closed his eyes.
"Jammed," Garrus said. "They let us make contact. Sabodan will rush in, guns blazing, and then they'll strike. Even if the fleet manages to break off, casualties will be high."
Raquen sat back. There was no good option. Their shields were faltering, their guns were running dry, and their hull was bleeding fire. Soon, the assault boats would come, slinking through the black, and then there'd be no time for anything but fighting. No way to warn the White Scars. No way to escape. There was only one sure way to prevent Sabodan from falling into the trap.
"The choice is out of our hands."
He pushed himself to his feet.
"We must warn the fleet. Ready all guns. Come to a collision heading with the nearest enemy vessel on my mark. I begin preparations to overload the plasma reactors."
"My lord,"
Garrus asked quietly.
"We need to send up a flare, brother. A warning to break off."
Raquen clasped his hands behind his back.
"One way or another, and I intend to give them that warning. Three ships, save for the price of one. A good bargain. It would be better if we were not the ship in question," Garrus said. "Yes, well, you can't have everything."
Raquen looked at the viewscreen. Alarm klaxons wailed as the ship slid to a new heading, engines groaning. He gestured.
"Set collision course. Prime all guns. Engage!"
Raven's Valor began its last flight. Raquen knew that Sabodan would detect their destruction and break off, retreating into the debris field. Or perhaps farther than that. What was left of the fleet would be saved. A satisfactory conclusion. He smiled.
"Now, let us show them how ravens die."
Elmais, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. Calder did not wait for the guards to open the doors to the council chamber. He pushed them aside and shoved the doors open. The ecumenical council was in session, and the air was thick with cloying clouds of incense. Over 20 deacons, aristocrats and priests of rank, sat arrayed about the table, accompanied by their scribes and adepts. Most of them were talking over one another, either arguing some point or directing complaints to Aemon, who sat at the far end of the table. Tyre stood behind his chair, hands clasped behind his back. The swordmaster nodded to Calder as he caught sight of him, and a slight smile spread across his scarred features. Heads turned as Calder made his way to the center of the chamber, steadfastly ignoring all attempts by servants and guards to stop him. Aemon looked up from the stack of documents he was examining and stood.
"Lieutenant, to what do we owe this unexpected visit?"
He smiled. Come to commandeer the ornamental gardens on the southern edge of the spire for the defence effort? Deacons and priests laughed politely, but Cowder could sense their concern.
The enemy is approaching since the range of Almace, he said, without preamble.
His voice, amplified by his helmet's vox, carried throughout the chamber. Silence fell. The smile slipped from Eamon's face.
You're certain?
I've received an astropathic communication from Sir Bodan Khan. His efforts to bleed the enemy fleets have met with little result. Their numbers have, in fact, swelled.
Eamon closed his eyes.
How is this possible?
Pirates, Tyre said. The outer sector and the asteroid fields are full of them. Most are no threat, but get enough of them together. Surely even a horde of pirates is no threat to the vaunted ships of the Adeptus Astartes, a priest called out.
Murmurs of assent rose from the crowd. Calder nodded.
They are not. The enemy fleet, however, is not solely composed of stolen cutters or badly maintained frigates. There are at least 10 warships remaining, including a battle barge, and most of them are heading this way, even as we speak.
Can the system defense fleet not slow them down? Someone called out. Else, what is it good for?
The fleet has taken substantial losses doing just that, Calder said. They are still doing it, but they will not be able to draw off the bulk of the fleet. We must ready ourselves for the siege.
What about our orbital defences?
A woman asked. She was clad in the traditional garb of one of the planet's noble houses. Thick robes of crimson, layered with rectangular scales of gold and silver.
And is there not still a cruiser in orbit?
One cruiser against a fleet?
A deacon said dismissively.
It is better than nothing, she snapped. Perhaps we can use it to evacuate.
And go where? Eamon said. Though he spoke quietly, everyone fell silent.
Where would you go, Artesia? Would you abandon your family's holdings, the people of this world?
He shook his head. No. The enemy are no longer a storm on the horizon. They are here, and we must make ready to withstand them.
More so than we already have, you mean?
Another deacon interjected.
How much more must we do?
And what have you done exactly, Averich? Eamon asked. Besides, clutter my desk with official complaints about your ornamental ponds being drained. He looked around. What have any of you done to ready your dioceses for what is coming? He paused.
I will tell you.
Nothing. You have left the preparations to me and to our saviours, as if by ignoring the issue you can make it go away. A murmur of protest rose at this, but Eamon shook his head.
No. I have given you every opportunity to contribute. Instead, you have wasted time pretending the problem isn't there. The time for argument is past.
The murmurs grew louder. Calder could see that the council was not used to being chastised. Eamon glanced at him and then gestured to Tyre.
Swordmaster, bring this meeting to order.
Tyre stood, drew his sidearm and fired into the air. A shocked silence fell. Eamon sighed and nodded.
Thank you, Domenico.
My pleasure, Cardinal Governor.
Eamon looked at Calder.
Well, Lieutenant, what's first?
Calder looked around the chamber. He could smell fear on the air and see resentment in every eye. The representatives of the ecclesiarchy were not used to being powerless.
Preliminary preparations have been completed. All that remains is the dispersal of forces to pre-approve locations. The city has three major arteries, to the east, the west, and the south. We will collapse the westernmost causeways, leaving the eastern and southern approaches viable for a ground assault.
Would it not be better to collapse them all?
No. The enemy will enter the city. That much is a given.
Calder saw the looks on their faces and softened his tone.
Reports from Pergamon indicate that they have the numbers and the materials to do so. This city was not designed to withstand a conventional siege.
He turned back to the hololithic projection.
Thus, we must ensure that if they are going to enter the city, they do so on our terms.
Aemon spoke up for the first time. Collapsing the western causeways will all but seal off the lower sections of the city. Millions will be trapped, even with the evacuation efforts that are already underway. The Cardinal Governor sounded tired. Cowder looked at him.
Yes.
Are we to abandon them? From Aemon's tone, Cowder suspected that he already knew the answer. The question was for the benefit of his subordinates, then. Cowder felt a brief flicker of annoyance. There were currents here that he could but dimly perceive, and he disliked being used in such a way. Nevertheless, he answered,
"Some must be sacrificed to maintain the whole."
The words hung in the air for a moment. Then one of the Ministerium priests spoke up.
"Pretty enough death sentence," he said.
He was a tall man, built heavy, and dressed in plain robes. Shaggy greying hair merged with a tangled beard to create a grizzled lion's mane, but the eyes within it were a vibrant green. Calder knew his face from reports. To Brain Hast. He was responsible for the shrines in Lowtown, and oversaw a contingent of nearly 100 subordinate priests. Thanks to them, a number of civil disturbances had been headed off before they could erupt into violence.
"How many of our flock must die to preserve the rest?"
Tobrain turned to Aemon.
"Such arithmetic is beyond me, brother." "Cardinal Governor Tobrain," Tyre said, with a touch of warning. "Not brother, not here. Best you remember that."
"I remember enough, Dominico,"
Tobrain growled. He turned his glare on the other man.
"I remember Aemon's promise of rescue, of salvation. Instead, we are to let our chapels burn and the faithful with them. And for what?"
He looked around, and Calder saw a few others nod, as if in agreement.
"The promise of victory," Calder said.
They turned to look at him. Most looked hurriedly away, save for Tyre and Tobrain. The heavyset priest frowned.
"A Pyrrhic victory," he said.
Aemon spoke up.
"But a victory. Else, what was it all for?"
He moved among his subordinates, meeting the eyes of each.
"We do not ask for this burden, but it has fallen upon us. The God Emperor, in his eternal wisdom, has set us to bar the way of hell. We will bleed for it. We may perish."
He made a fist.
"But we will do this thing. That is our purpose. We are his voice made flesh, and it is for us to carry out his will. We can do no less."
"And what about the rest of us?"
another priest spoke up. Calder glanced at him. Depeche Klein, the Lord Deacon of Feinguard's Landing, one of the smaller Agri cities on the southern coast.
"You've sent a handful of space marines to each city to prepare defences, but that's nowhere near enough to protect us."
"In all previous contacts, the enemy focused on the planetary nerve centre. Other cities and urban Habsburgs came under attack only in the latter stages of the siege. So long as Almacia stands, they will not come for you in force."
"Can you promise that?"
the noblewoman, Artesia, asked. Calder paused, weighing his answer.
"No, I can promise nothing, save that we will do as we must to defend this world."
Before another uproar could begin, Aemon clapped his hands for silence.
"I propose that we bring this council session to a halt. Those of you who wish to return to your dioceses should do so now. The rest of you may stay here, if you wish. I will, of course, extend the Cathedral Palace's hospitality to any who wish it."
As the meeting broke up, Aemon joined Calder, Tyre trailing in his wake.
"Tyre tells me Lieutenant Karros and a contingent of Raven Guard set off for the asteroid mining facilities this morning. I trust he understands the value of those facilities, both to Almis and this system.
He does, Calder said.
Karros had assured him that he would bring the mines under control swiftly. How he intended to do that exactly, Calder wasn't sure. But he trusted Karros to find the most efficient path forward.
And what about the system defense fleet? Is there any way they can reach us before the enemy?
Unlikely. I left the decision to Sabodan Khan.
Was that wise?
He's more experienced in void warfare than I am, and he better understands the capabilities and values of his ships.
He decided not to mention that Sabodan's last message had been a garbled mess. The astropathic choirs were suffering as much from the presence of the arch-enemy as the more mundane communication systems. Perhaps more. As far as his calculations went, the Silent Horseman no longer figured in them. If Sabodan still lived, then Calder had no doubt that the Khan would do what he could to reach Almes. If he did not, doubtless he had died bravely. Eamon frowned.
Answer me truthfully. How much time?
A few days at most. The fleet bought us more time than I expected, but it won't be enough. Work will continue until the last moment, but this city is sub-optimal in terms of defensive strategies. There is not much we can do.
Calder looked down at Eamon.
I have formulated a dozen theories as to the purpose behind this attack. None of them are satisfactory.
Eamon stiffened and then turned away. Hands behind his back, he started towards the windows that overlooked the city.
Does it matter? Eamon asked, as Calder fell into step beside him.
Without knowing why, I cannot know if the defensive preparations are adequate.
I'm sure you've done the best you can.
Calder looked at him. Eamon flinched back. Calder heard the scrape of steel and knew that Tyre had his hand on his sword. He ignored the swordmaster and focused on Eamon.
You are hiding something. We both know this. There is a 60% chance that this obfuscation directly relates to the current situation.
He shook his head.
I told you that the time was coming when I would not take no for an answer.
Eamon stopped. Calder could read the nervousness in his body language. He noted the way Tyre set himself, just out of the corner of his eye. The swordmaster's hand had dropped to the hilt of his blade. Calder was unarmed, but he calculated 8 ways of disarming Tyre without killing him. He hoped that it wouldn't come to that.
Is that time now?
Eamon asked softly. Calder gazed out of the window for a moment.
You have 36 standard hours to decide your next course of action.
Without waiting for a reply, he turned towards the doors, brushing past Tyre as he did so.
I suggest you prey on it.
Almes, Primus Asteroid Facilities. A dozen black armored forms trudged across the surface of the asteroid. Karros had point, as was his privilege as commander. Above him, the stars spun, cold and wild and heedless. The asteroid was pitted with lightless chasms and marked by mountains of silicate. It was one of a dozen larger bodies, comprising part of the inner region of the belt that girdled Almes. A planetoid in all but name. A web of man-made structures stretched across the inner belt, connected by leagues of shunt tubes and orbital causeways. The mining facilities had grown, stretching from one asteroid to the next with every passing century. Now, the Primus facility was a city in and of itself. Smaller outposts dotted the belt, reachable only by jump craft or ore hauler. Karras's battle plate scanned his surroundings, noting the high level of iron, nickel and other valuable elements. Even after all this time, there were deposits yet unplumed. There were only a few asteroids of similar composition in the belt. Most of the rest were carbonaceous or silicate-rich, all showed signs of mining. Around the Raven Guard were signs of industry. Ore scrapers rose like iron ziggurats over great holes gouged in the surface of the asteroid, and pipelines meant to carry fuel stretched between far-flung outposts. Unmanned docking platforms towered over everything, and a canopy of gantries and cabling stretched between them. A shadow passed over the Raven Guard. A Servitor-controlled ore hauler drifted far overhead, thrusters aiming towards the nearest docking station. Karras watched it for a moment, noting the thick hull, built to withstand celestial debris and the scooped, ram shape of its prow, the better to push past chunks of rock and ice. As if reading his mind, one of his warriors, Darren, murmured,
"Strap a few guns to it, and it'd make an acceptable assault bolt."
He spoke across an encrypted Vox channel. No sense in alerting anyone of their arrival before they absolutely had to.
"I was thinking explosives," Karras said, "like the fire ships of ancient Ilium."
Past the ore hauler and above, he could see a column of refugee ships navigating the asteroid belt. Their immense shadows darken the asteroid's expanse, like the sudden fall of night. There weren't many of them, and most of them were small, private yachts and the like. They'd fled across the system, only to find themselves in the eye of the storm once more.
"Speaking of ships, why are we walking?"
another warrior asked. This one was called Spyros.
"Why not simply take the gunship in?"
The Thunderhawk that had brought them to the asteroid was concealed some distance away, awaiting Karras' orders.
"I didn't want to risk getting knocked out of the void by a mining laser or a debris battery."
Karras glanced back.
"That would be quite humiliating, don't you agree?"
Spyros grunted.
"More sensor this way. No alarms," Darren said.
Karras smiled.
"A gunship would have been picked up on short-range augurs, even with sensor baffles. Their system is built to detect minute debris particles. A speck of rock the size of your thumb can punch a hole in something vital out here. They'd have spotted us, even if they weren't sure what we were."
He looked around.
"But this way, they won't see us coming." "Unless they look out a porthole,"
Spyros said.
"Or there are scanners we didn't detect. Or they noticed the gunship when it landed. Yes, if any or all of those things happen, they'll be waiting for us,"
Karras said with a slight sigh.
"Do you have a point, Spyros? Or are you just being your usual optimistic self?" "Merely contributing to the overall strategic picture, brother. And I thank you for that. But in the future, consider saving those contributions until I ask for them."
Karras looked back at the other Raven Guard.
"Are we clear?"
"Clear,"
Spyros said. He sounded suitably chastened, and Darren and the others chuckled throatily. Karras allowed himself a smile. A certain structured informality was often of benefit, but only off the battlefield.
"Good."
Karras turned back and paused.
"Down."
As one, the Raven Guard sank down, crouching so that the camo cloaks they wore covered them completely. A moment later, a maintenance scow trundled close by, overhead. Augurs set into its hull scanned the nearby machinery, looking for damage or flaws.
"The engine sears are still working,"
Darren murmured. The Voxlink crackled slightly with background interference. Spyros laughed.
"Even revolutionaries aren't foolish enough to interfere with the servants of the machine god going about their duties."
Karras waited until the scow was out of auger range and rose to his feet.
"Come. The enforcers will be arriving soon. We need to be there to meet them." "We don't need them,"
Spyros said. The others murmured agreement. None of them had been particularly impressed by Regulator Galba and his enforcers. They were a sloppy lot and brutal. Unsurprising, considering the nature of the posting, this was a punishment detail. In practice, if not in name. Karras had scanned Galba's file on the journey. It was littered with infractions, mostly violent. He had a reputation for brutality. It was no wonder Tyre had assumed that Galba would simply execute the miners.
"No, but they need us. That is why we are here, to keep the situation from complicating matters any further."
Beneath his feet, the rocky surface of the asteroid gave way to ferrocrete and rusty metal. Up close, this part of the facility resembled a factory, save for the atmospheric shielding that obscured large sections. Shunt tubes and enclosed walkways extended from it in all directions, connecting to various towers and pods. Hundreds of heavy solar generators were visible, clustered like barnacles at the base of the main structure, their receptor cells angled to catch the light of the sun. His helmet's auto-senses clicked and hummed, bringing the exterior of the main facility into sharp focus. His tactical helm display selected possible entry points. He gestured.
Spyros, Jane, left with me. Daron, you and the others make your way to the right. Get the airlocks open on the tertiary gantries and hold them until the enforcers arrive.
Lethal force?
Daron rumbled. Karras paused.
Non-lethal, if possible. We don't want to kill them. Not yet.
They are insurrectionists,
Jane said. It was not a protest or an accusation, merely a statement. Karras glanced at him.
Yes, and potentially useful ones. Non-lethal.
Clicks of acknowledgement sounded on the vox. There would be no more talking from here on out. Not until the mission was complete. They moved quickly after that. While they had maintained a controlled pace in their approach, this was discarded now in favor of speed. Servos hummed as motive fiber bundles bunched and twisted, lending extra speed to an already powerful stride. Concealed air jets helped them maintain a solid footing as they bounded towards the main facility. Karras conducted a localized frequency scan as he moved. He could hear the miners talking to one another. Their attentions were firmly fixed on the enforcers who were attempting to breach the facility. The rebels had welded most of the access hatches and rigged the rest with mining explosives. By the time he'd swung himself up onto an entrance gantry, he'd identified which was which and headed for the closest of the booby-trapped hatches. He motioned for Spyros and Chain to spread out on the gantry. As Karras advanced down the walkway, the other two covered him. The access hatch was a solid piece, with a simple pressurized release mechanism. He ran a hand along the frame, letting the tactile sensors in his gauntlet build him an image